Joe and I had, were invited to this, one of the Australian women, mm-hmm. get her name right off, to her home. She had a nice home, she had mm-hmm. a car.
Mm-hmm. Oh, ooh.
Yeah. And she had friends in.
Car, not even a Jeep.
Oh, no, no, she had a nice Volkswagen.
Uh-huh.
Nice
Volkswagen? Isn't that a contradiction in terms?
In Laos, that was, for a volunteer, right. this was big. She had a nice Volkswagen.
Yeah.
And she had a beautiful home.
Uh-huh.
And she brought us to, invited Joe and I to dinner. And so we had the dinner. She had friends in from Borneo, and Joe and I had been in Borneo on vacation. So This was very nice. We had a wonderful dinner. She had servants. Most people in Laos did have servants.
Yeah.
And after the dinner, we finished the dinner. We had dessert. We had drinks. And she said, I'd like to take my friends out to visit some places. So we go see some temples.
Uh-huh.
So Joe and I, we got in the car, and she had two males now that could go places, okay, freely. With comfort. That's what we were there for. And we at the time, Joe and I didn't realize that, but we had invited basically as sort of chaperones and males that could go places where women would not be comfortable doing this.
You mean her friends from Borneo, although it's now Kalimantan, but anyway,
yeah,
were females also?
One of them was female. I think they may have been both female. I'm not real sure. I don't remember it real clear.
So three women couldn't go off to the temples alone, but three women plus two men, no problem.
No problem.
And well, only because of the two men.
Oh, it gets
if
better.
It had been five women, it just as impossible?
The story gets, okay. Well, yeah. It wasn't impossible necessarily to go to the temples. They could have probably done that without Joe and I.
Okay.
So we go to the temple, and we see the temple, and oh, this is real nice. And we get back to the car, and she says, well, let's go to the White Rose.
Which
now,
is?
That's something women would not go by themselves. Obviously, no one has talked to you about the White Rose.
No. What's the White Rose?
The White Rose is a place of entertainment.
Yeah, that I gathered.
White Rose, even though there were no officially any troops in Laos,
mm-hmm.
White Rose got written up in Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a place of male entertainment. It was, it was a place that you basically, when people came into country on their first night, you basically, we piled them in some Willie's Jeeps, and we took them to the White Rose. This was sort of an introduction. Anything that was possible, imaginable, of a sexual nature took place at the White Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Either privately or in groups where so people could see it. The thing that the most that I ever saw there was table dancing,
mm-hmm.
Various manipulations of the body mm-hmm. using various implements, mostly natural,
mm-hmm.
bananas,
yeah.
Cigarettes. Some of the stuff you've heard before, haven't
yeah.
you? Okay. And I hope this is not a female listening to this tape. and I apologize. So that was really what we were there for. Is that, you know, the whole process
that way
of the
they
dinner,
could get in.
The dinner, the temples, the whole thing was this process leading up to the White. That's the bottom. That's where she really wanted to take these people, was the White Rose. So there's a lot of pilots there. When I was there, normally there were pilots. We had Air America and Continental Air pilots, which probably you're aware of already, basically subsidized by the CIA.
Sure.
These guys wore lots of gold. You've mm-hmm. heard the story already.
Yeah,
so that they could bargain their way out of the hill should they crash.
Yeah.
So they had large, just for the tape, they had large gold bracelets, identification bracelets, very heavy gold.
Yeah.
Very heavy gold watches with gold watch bands.
I was going to say the watches in particular. Yeah.
Just incredibly large. I never saw so much gold on a human being.
Not until Mr. T.
Yeah. Yeah. These people would be there in groups. They were paid very high. I think they were making like $1,000 a week or something.
Yeah.
They were there drinking. And we didn't pay for a table dancer, but these guys paid for the table dancer. And they
for you?
For us. Well, they were for their table, but because we had women with us, which normally were not present in the White Rose.
Yeah.
These guys were fairly drunk, and they'd tell the table dancer, go over to the other table. So she came over, and she did her thing right in front of these women. And Joe was also brought up Catholic, and Joe and I are very plussed about. We're getting really embarrassed by this.
Yeah, you're
really embarrassed.
You're beet red.
And the Australian's name was Ray. And
in fact, you're red now.
Yeah,
just remembering.
Yeah. Ray was beautiful. You know, because we're embarrassed, and Ray goes, "They're just like children." It was like she was saying, They don't understand what they're doing.
Yeah. You know,
it's you're having the problem. They're not having any problem doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
But that, I told the story basically because of the where women could not do what men could do.
Yeah, and that's, well, no, I think there's a lot in that story that people would see and use to analyze in terms of the woman's role and mm-hmm. limits and mores at the time and, mm-hmm. and all of this sort of stuff. Did any of the, what about, you know, it's a wonderful story about them sending over the table dancer for you, quite unexpectedly. Was there a lot of contact between you and some of these pilots? Or was it more just awareness of each other as existed?
There was some contact.
Because mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you had to fly around the country.
Mm-hmm. I didn't fly that much. I'm not.
Well, you were in Vientiane, but people from outside had to get to Vientiane,
yeah.
and it was by Air America.
Air America and Continental.
Yeah.
It was free.
Yeah,
I went to Hong Kong by Air America free.
Okay, right.
It was a
yeah.
summer trip. You would meet them at parties. Met them at Lao parties. I mm-hmm. met them at English and AID parties.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, dinner out was not an exceptional thing, and
with
parties were not exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
And so you did run into Air America people. You
mm-hmm.
ran into what they used to call special requirements, which were you didn't talk to about.
No,
special requirements was a part of AID that was made up of military people on leave, and basically what they did is they handled military logistics.
Oh, okay.
For
all right.
For
yeah,
the
yeah,
Lion,
yeah.
for whoever was in country.
Okay.
And so we ran into a lot of people that were similar to the Continental Air people.
I mean,
you ran into people that were there for various reasons,
mm-hmm.
And it wasn't necessarily, they weren't necessarily bettering the situation.
No. Well, you're in a war zone.
Yeah. And it was a war zone with very nice frills. I mean, you on the surface you could not see it.
Mm-hmm.
It was only when you got into situations like this and you knew what was going on, particularly in the Capitol, you would not see it. It was not real obvious in the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
We had Pathet Lao in the Capitol, but they were
official representatives.
Mm-hmm. But I never had any contact with the Pathet Lao, because they never came to the parties and were never invited.
Gee, I wonder why.
I went to a
CIA pilot, meet the Lao, Pathet Lao representative, right. Pathet Lao representative,
yeah,
here's
were,
your CIA rep.
They were never invited. I was at Vang Pao's house once for a party.
Oh, were you really? Okay.
Yes, I was at Vang Pao's house for a party once. Nope. There were Lao pilots there. They
yeah.
were delightful. That was
really?
The, oh, yes, they were trained in El Paso, I think.
Uh-huh.
And they spoke English, which was exceptional for
yes.
people of that age in Laos, because most of the cultured people there spoke French.
Right.
And but there were a lot of people trained in English because they had to do certain jobs.
Sure.
And the pilots who had been trained in the United States and Texas primarily, I think. And we had some wonderful conversations with them. And what happens at the parties is you get with these Lao pilots, and it was just, you know, just wonderful. They could speak English, they could talk, and they could tell stories, and that was probably the most, I think Lao pilots were probably the most fun I had with Lao.
Really? Well, what would they tell stories of?
All about their time in Texas and things that happened. They would tell stories of funny things that happened and mistakes they made, and they were just
the cross-cultural
things. Cross-cultural things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. No, but I was saying that I think that a lot of people would be able to see, what was the name of this Australian woman?
Oh, Ray Blazing.
Ray. We'll hear Ray's story.
Oh,
or,
yeah.
You know,
a lot of the students remember Ray. She was a real sweetheart.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. She's very well liked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was thinking of people who could learn, because what were, let me pause this for a second here.
Do you want somebody to drink or something before we start again?
Oh, before we start again? I'm going to not...
You want to use the bathroom?
Yes. I'm going to not just pause it, I'll turn it off here.
Okay.
Something that we were saying off... Well, something... let me pause for a second. Tape now, and it's rolling again. Which, you know, and an off-top... For the sake of the listener or later transcript. We were talking off tape about some people that we know who had some, let's say, high anxiety problems and had to leave the country, both Laos, and in the case of Richard's case, and the Philippines, in my case, through Peace Corps. And generally that brings up the idea of culture shock, which all volunteers have to deal with at some level. And some, it becomes really traumatic and they can't take it. Whether they have to be transported back or whether they say, I quit, you know, or whether, you know, that's on the one extreme. And the other extreme, some people just take it and say, hey, these are differences, I'll embrace them. You know, and they hardly miss a beat. You know, and there's all sorts of people on between. What were some of the things when you to get back to a kind of chronological development here, after Harper's Ferry, they sent you off. What were some of the culture things that you first noticed? Because this is a new world. This is even much different from Texas.
Okay. I had already taught in the United States. In Laos, I didn't have that many classes. My classes were limited. In fact, they would assign me extra classes, and I still didn't have enough classes. I mean, it was we weren't worked that hard class-wise. It was more like teaching in junior college or college. So when people would leave and they didn't have someone to cover a class, they'd give it to me, and I'd take it, and it wasn't enough. I still had time on my hands. too much time on my hands. The way you were treated as a teacher in Laos, there was a respect. The older students, that some of them that had been to the States, they'd been in American field service experiences. We used to call them cowboys because they came back ruined. they were, you know, they had no discipline, they had no interest in study. They had too much fun with their American family.
Yeah.
And I recommend that we stop that. AFS. I don't think that happened, but I recommended that we stop it because it was not good for the students. But the regular students that had not been to the States, particularly the younger ones that weren't used to Americans, would bow to you. I mean, they would stop when you walked up past them, and they would stop and they would bow their heads to you. They would call you Ajahn, which is master, versus Naiku, which is teacher, which is what we should have been called. Got a lot more credit than we deserved. The thing that probably bothered me the most was language. I never excelled at language. I remember sharing a car with an AIDS person, AID. AIDS means so much different now. AID person. I remember him telling me this in the car, and it was true. He said the most important thing you need to do here is learn the language. He said, every person I've ever known in this country that's made any kind of contribution learned the language.
This is an AID guy?
Yeah, the AID people, a lot of them came out of IVMs. So
Was this a former volunteer?
I think it probably was a former volunteer.
Okay, all right, that makes sense.
And these were not executives. I mean, Indochina, you had just an incredible amount of American money there. And just the American presence was just overwhelming. And it was very easy for people in the administration of AID to pick up an IVS volunteer. And they had a lot of positions to fill. And so to fill those positions, IVS volunteers were perfect. They had language skills, they had experience, they knew who these people were, they know they survived 2 years here already. So you had a lot of rural people that putting in pumps and doing this kind of thing that wasn't really something IVS did. But AID did it, and they had a lot of IVS people going out and drilling for wells and things. So there were a lot of IVS people running around in AIDS positions.
So that was one of the.
I think he was one of them.
Yeah. Okay. So both the respect that you got from students, and your need for language, were two jolts to your system.
Yes.
What other sorts of things?
the male-female thing, I think, was traveling with the girl's friends was a culture thing.
The dating and behavior.
The dating behavior was a change. And you have to realize that except for 1 year previous to that, I've been 5 years in a religious order.
Right.
So it was kind of a strange thing for me. It was almost like being in a religious life again. Not exactly, though. I'm trying to think of things. I guess language, culture, you know, the problem with, and like I said, remember I said that had I gone to San Tong, I probably would have had a different experience than being in Vincennes. John Doak had too many Americans. Mm-hmm. Vincennes had too many Americans. And so the opportunity, and you probably have heard this already, the opportunity not to get culture, not to become a part of the Lao culture was too easy. Some stuff is too easy. Some things you have to be forced into.
Okay.
And on occasion, I think that probably I would have been better had I gone someplace other than, you know, Don Doak was a wonderful opportunity. It was a big school, had a lot of people to relate to, but you could so easily be cut off from the Lao culture. Now, Peace Corps was very good about this, I think, and they protected the people from it. They made you suffer a lot more hardships. We did not have hardships in Laos. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We had embassy cards. Mm-hmm. We could go to the canteen. We could, you know, I could go to get a hamburger and you know, I could go to the 9 kilometers or 7 kilometers or whatever it was into town. I could get a hamburger or...
you mean the AID compound?
The AID compound.
I think it was actually kilometer 6.
Congress 6 was the living area.
Oh, I see.
That was like a subdivision in the States.
Yeah.
It would be not too much dissimilar to the subdivision we're in right now.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was like somebody just picked up a subdivision and put it in Laos.
Yeah.
With a chain link fence around it.
Yeah.
And border guards.
Like the American military bases in the Philippines
I
knew.
I'm sure they're the same architect.
Yeah. Well, of course, the architecture was a little similar, you know, it didn't have as much individuality as your subdivision here, mm-hmm. but still.
Yeah, but it wasn't, from my standpoint, and I can say that in retrospect now, I didn't do much to change that, and we were discouraged from changing it.
From changing, what do you mean?
From your living arrangements. There were some people that recognized that their living arrangements were too cushy, that they weren't too far from the people. We had people move into villages.
Uh-huh.
But what you were told basically was that they weren't keeping themselves clean, they weren't, you know, they weren't adequately hygienic.
The volunteers?
Volunteers.
Really? Because I think that was Walt was one of them.
Walt was one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't strike me as an unhygienic person.
Yeah. Walt wasn't an unhygienic person. Walt was a nice person. I mean, there is the temptation when you don't have hot water. A village in Laos were not much.
Mm-hmm.
A village was not much developed. I mean, you, like in the compound where we were at the school, when Walt lived in the compound, Walt had hot water. We had hot water. Well, the difference between having hot water and not having hot water, having water that you can turn the tap on versus going outside to a barrel, the difference having a flush toilet and going to the out in the bush is another world.
Yes, I know.
It's very different. So there was some discouragement about doing it, but some people did it. Dennis
mm-hmm.
did it for a time.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis did it for a time. But he lived in a house just on the edge of campus, where Walt actually did live in a village.
Yeah, yeah, I know that Walt said that.
He talked to me about his, he said, like, you don't have personal items if you stay. I guess he stayed with some people, too, in town, he might have, for a time. Walt really got into it. Walt
mm-hmm.
was very good about this. He got very much into it. Talked about personal items and stuff like that you shared everything and
mm-hmm.
the culture. I don't think I really had a great deal of, you know, other than the language thing and certain customs and making some faux pas as far as how how you address people and how you touch them. You don't touch them certain ways. You don't touch heads. This kind of
right.
thing.
Then they're like Thai in that sense.
Yeah. physical contact. But the thing is that I don't think I became much more than, in this, I don't know if you probably heard this before, that I still stayed pretty much an American. I didn't really have to change cultures that much.
Okay, all right.
Too easy to stay very much American.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking that Walt would probably say that he's still American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
But his experience, I think, was much more cultural,
mm-hmm.
culturally enriching as far as Islamist mm-hmm. was mm-hmm. than mine was. And I take responsibility for that.
Any regret?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but there's also, I would have paid a price either way. There's other things that I would not have experienced had I gone to a village.
Okay.
Versus this.
Yeah, what sort of things did you experience by not going into a village?
I probably had more time because of the conveniences that I had.
Uh-huh.
I probably got some work done that I probably would have had trouble getting done in the village. You know,
okay.
I had electric lights.
Mm-hmm.
I had, you know, I painted my apartment. I sort of enjoyed that. And I spent time with other volunteers, probably had more opportunity to do that. I got to know some of the French teachers.
That's true, too.
To them.
Maybe the Britishers.
Yeah, the Britishers. I saw them. There probably were, you know, friendships and stuff, trips I took because I was in the compound and this was connected to other people that were uh-huh. connected with other people. The networking probably was a little better.
This just popped into my mind.
Mm-hmm.
How many British and French folks were there and versus Americans? And give me a snapshot of how many white faces mm-hmm. and who were they?
My guess is that there were probably an equal number of French as there were Americans. We were putting up the money, but there was a French section to the school.
Uh-huh.
Plus, in town, there was a lycée that was French.
Okay.
There was a French business in town, French restaurants. How much? I don't know if I ever went to a restaurant that was run by a Frenchman, but there were restaurants that had French cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
There was an Alliance Française. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of a French cultural center there where you could take French things. I got to know some of the French teachers. Again, I denied myself experiences that I really, you know, I could have studied French while I was there. I didn't do that.
Your wife's making you
my
do that.
My wife is making me do that.
So that's fine.
I always wonder, I wish I'd had her there. She would have enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, maybe.
But if I had been married at the time, I probably would never have done this.
True. Yeah.
I had a chance to tutor a kid in English that was a child of a Frenchman. I didn't do it, and I should have. I have a lot of regrets about this kind of thing. I could have had that experience, and he was a wonderful man.
Well, you know.
Different of a Frenchman.
Yeah.
But I did other things. I was to help him with that. There were things that they didn't. The French are not real big for certain mechanical things. I'm more mechanical, so I would do things mechanically for people, which I didn't. You know, if I had not been in the compound, I would not have been able to do that.
Right, right.
Hot wire cars, this kind of thing.
Take them for joyrides.
I hot wired a couple Jeeps for the French.
Yeah. No, I was wondering how many Americans were at the school?
About let's see.
10, 12?
I can count them for you.
Oh.
2, 4, 6, 8. I would say about 20 IBS volunteers.
That many?
Yeah, easily.
Yeah.
Easily 20. There were no other American there was the head of our English section that was allowed, though. No, I'd say about 20 there, plus the rural people, plus the administration.
Well, I wanted to get a snapshot of Dundalk.
Yeah.
So you had 20, and then you had another 20
probably
Frenchmen.
I would say an equal number of Frenchmen.
So that's 40 of the faculty.
But these were professional teachers. They were different than we were.
Right. But I just wanted to get, you mm-hmm. know, an idea. And then Britishers?
We had...
there's statistics in there?
Not statistics, they're faces.
Okay.
Let's see. There's a picture here of the faculty. If I come, If I get a hold of that, then I can just count faces, and I don't see it.
Are you sure that this, you're looking through the book that Dennis
did?
How do you pronounce his name?
Rimposky.
Put together.
Mm-hmm.
Of Dundalk and the students and their activities and the classrooms. I don't remember seeing a faculty photo.
I would say there were seven to eight.
Okay.
British. The Japanese weren't there. The Japanese were doing rural projects primarily. We didn't have any Japanese at Dundalk.
Okay. So how many Lao teachers would there be then?
Probably at Lao were in the administration. They did a lot of the running of the dormitories. They ran the dormitories and the food service. Teaching, probably five. Probably not as many.
As even the British?
As even the British, no.
So this was very much foreign faculty.
Very much foreign faculty. Well, here's the administration. There are one an Australian, Ray, and the IVS advisor,
uh-huh.
and three...
Who was Lau, Walt Johnson.
Walt Johnson, and three administrators.
Uh-huh.
And here is the faculty. This is some more administration. These are primarily Lau. Yeah. This was a dorm. She ran a dorm.
Okay.
He ran a dorm. So you get a pretty good picture there. On faculty, British is one...
That looks far fewer than, like, 50, which...
I only see one British here, but I know there were at least five. And then IVS, looks like there's more IVS there than I would have guessed. I'm counting 8, 9, 10, 11. I'm counting 11. Two Australians both Australians, or one of the Australians I see here, were two Australians. 11 IVS I'm counting here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm counting two British CUSO volunteers, but I think there were at least five. Because I remember two guys. Both of these are women, and at least two
guys. Let me pause this and go over this photograph with you so that I can see. I'm actually going to turn it on.
Oh, good.
We were just looking at the pictures and in this book and seeing younger faces of people, and you started to talk about Dr. Porter, and I turned this thing back on again because I'm doing a blank. Someone else who was at Dundalk probably a little bit later than you, although maybe at the same time, also knew, I guess it was Jerry Porter, actually. I'm going to pause this while I try to think of the name. Inverson?
Yes.
Okay.
No, Inverson.
Okay, because I saw he and Bun Heng in Washington last summer, and he shared with me some of those newsletters
mm-hmm.
that he would write home, mm-hmm. and I made some photocopies of them, and he had some from Porter also, and gave those to me too. Well, not didn't give them to me, loaned them to me, mm-hmm. and I made photocopies. And it was he who told me that Porter was no longer around. Okay. But anyway, you had a Porter story.
Well, a number of Porter stories. Porter, as you probably know, Porter was single. He was a retired professor
mm-hmm.
in science.
Mm-hmm.
Porter worked very hard.
Yeah.
Very hard worker. Very good. And he was an example. I don't know whether we were really prepared at our age to deal with the example that Dr. Porter set, but he was truly in the old school of professors. And I used to have class, at a point I had a class just ahead of him, and I was an American teacher with all the bad aspects of being just a little bit too loose. I was hard in tests and stuff, but I did do my classes and I was prepared, but I wasn't as prepared as Dr. Porter was prepared,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't as driven to do the job that Dr. Porter. I mean, Dr. Porter was, when I talk about preparation for class, which I believe to be incredibly important in class, in teaching, is preparation. Dr. Porter was very prepared. And it was almost dangerous to have the classroom ahead of Dr. Porter, because you would be finishing up and Dr. Porter would be at the doorway with his arms full of books and materials that he was bringing into the classroom, and he would practically run you out the door so he could start his class. He was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting person to interview would be his son. He had an adopted son.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Porter lived, for a while, Dr. Porter lived on the edge of grounds, in a house on the edge of grounds with his son. And I oftentimes felt that Dr. Porter did this to keep the son away from American influences, because he wanted the son to be Asian and to keep a lot of, and he kept the son not in the American section, in the English section, he kept his son in the French section, where there was a much higher standard of education.
Ah, uh-huh.
Lovely boy, a lovely boy.
Was he an adopted son?
Yes, okay. An adopted son. One summer, Dr. Porter sent the son to Japan, to a mm-hmm. monastery. I think it was a Shinto shrine or a monastery for the summer, for experience, a very rigid experience. But Dr. Porter saw a lot of things, and brought.
I'm trying to remember Emerson's first name. I knew
Ivan.
Name.
Ivan?
No.
Ivan Emerson.
Oh. Pause while I try to think.
Emerson.
I think that may be it.
I think it might be
L. It is L. He told me that Porter stayed behind in Vientiane after the fall.
Oh, really?
And. Probably because he was so well known and had made the steps to, you know, integrate himself and had his son, and that they allowed him to stay. But by 76, certainly by 77, it was quite clear. It was made clear to him that they really didn't want him to stick around any longer, and that he finally left the country. And from there, I don't know where
mm-hmm.
he went to, but he stayed beyond.
He was
didn't scramble in 1975, because Al and Boon Heng had to, because Boon Heng did not want to. Al married the
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you knew Boon Heng.
I knew some people. Like, was she was a sec? Was she working in the IBS office or something?
As a summer help
mm-hmm.
sort of thing for the Lao students program,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's how they met. They worked together, basically,
mm-hmm.
and worked together and had, you know, and that sprouted into something much more than a working relationship. But they were already married, and she did not want to be left behind with an American husband. So they, you know, went across the Mekong, you know, at the last minute,
really,
that sort of stuff. But Jerry Porter stayed behind because he figured he was just going to try to continue to be a neutral teacher, you know, just doing his science. And that worked for a while, but only for about a year, year and a half at the most. And then finally it's like, you know, they didn't make any threats, but they let him know that, you know, they really didn't want to give him a government salary anymore, you know, that it was time for the old colonial presence of one sort or another to leave Laos.
I would have been very painful for me to see that. I would not have wanted to be there for that.
Yeah, because apparently he had invested a great deal of himself mm-hmm. into that.
Apparently there was a couple that did stay there up in Luang Prabang. My understanding is that they were Mennonites.
Uh-huh.
And they were permitted to stay, or they went back later and are in Laos now. But
that could happen, especially if they were Mennonite Central Committee. As opposed to IVS,
mm-hmm.
as IVS had the AID contract,
mm-hmm.
which would have tainted the organization
mm-hmm.
more.
But we were ex-IVSers, though.
Yeah, okay. Oh, all right, all right. Well, yeah.
But it's a touchy thing, and I can understand that. But yeah. I would not have wanted to see what happened. I would not have been there. I would not want to have seen the fall.
No,
I would not.
No.
It was bad enough, but I know that you know people suffered,
mm-hmm.
and that bothers me.
Yeah,
because I participated in that, and I think it needs to be on the tape that I participated in giving people an investment in something that wasn't going anywhere. And I can't stress that enough.
Yeah,
and I knew that when I did it.
Yeah, and I wanted to get to that, and in a sense I had to kind of take this chronologically, and then mm-hmm. I got detoured by that wonderful detour of being the senior talking to the
mm-hmm.
folks going off into, you know, in Harper's Ferry. But, you know, you come in, you have your adjustment in language and dealing with students and, you know, the pace of your teaching, and you were doing, if I remember right, yeah, their instructor of geography and political science and occasionally doing the teaching. But you said at another point in your survey that you handed back to us that you began to realize that after about a year that what you were doing was potentially harmful. How did you come to that realization?
To some degree, there were people in country, there were ex-IVSers that were still there,
mm-hmm.
as we've discussed, people that don't go home.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fellow there named Fred Braffman.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. everyone knows Fred Braffman.
Yeah.
Not personally, but I've read, you know, he's written so much and everything. Yeah.
And Fred was in country, and Fred had very strong views.
Mm-hmm.
And
still does.
And
my partner Mark visited him.
And I can't believe he's in this country.
in California.
Yeah. Southern California.
Probably.
Yeah.
Mark's from there too, they're birds of a feather. Although Mark would not want to hear that me say that. Gotcha, Mark.
He had very strong views, and so you heard, and I did some stuff for Fred. I did some work for Fred on one of his books. He had a book that he wanted a teacher's manual for him one summer. That was my project, is to write the teacher's
uh-huh,
manual
okay.
for him. Fred had very strong views, and I think Fred saw a lot, so you were exposed to Fred.
Mm-hmm.
Also, that you got to realize that there was a secret war here.
Mm-hmm.
Fact,
how did you realize that?
Well,
how is this?
Because people talked about this, and you talked about the pilots.
Mm-hmm.
You came to, and people would tell you, know, off the cuff or secretly or whatever, you couldn't take pictures of the Continental planes or the Air America planes. They did not want pictures taken at their facility. They had a separate facility there.
Mm-hmm.
it was at the airport, but you only, for some flights you took out of there, but normally you took them out of the regular airport. But they also had their own little terminal there. You saw the helicopters that had the interchangeable insignias,
uh-huh.
So that you could just change the insignia, whether they were in Vietnam or Laos or Thailand, you just switched the insignia for whatever country you were flying to. People told you about rice transports to the mountains, that was rice that Lao don't eat,
uh-huh.
Thai eat it, so you
uh-huh.
knew there were Thai soldiers in the mountains.
Uh-huh.
You knew from people, you knew how many, you knew that there were a lot of military advisors there. You knew there were a lot of AID people that were on leave from the military. This was not a secret. That they would, when they finished their tour in Laos, that they would go back and they would become active duty again. They were inactive at that time, performing different types of requirements, seeing that there were enough shells and enough bombs and planes were appropriate. So there was a real war effort going on here, very quietly, with a lot of class,
uh-huh.
but it was a secret war.
And you were just at the staging area.
Yeah, we were at one of the staging areas, probably one of the major staging areas. Some of the staging areas you couldn't get into, like Sam Tong was very limited who could get in there.
Right.
You talked the planes. There were different kinds of planes there that were used to land, the Porter planes that were
uh-huh.
used to land in short areas. You know, I saw one in a James Bond movie last year. And I said, oh my God, I know that plane. You never see those planes. And the plane does this little thing off the side of this mountain. And I'm going, I know what that plane is. Because that's what they flew up in the mountains.
Yes, I saw that movie too.
Yeah,
yeah okay. So So these are the things that you'd observe.
You observed it, and people talk about it. And the question became, what were you going to do about it?
Yeah.
What action do you take in this? excuse me. What are you supposed to do? And you also could see, you know, I read...
Put one of these?
No, it's okay.
Okay.
I read Time Magazine and Newsweek on a regular basis, and I knew that the war was not going well for us, and that we would ultimately have to leave. I knew we weren't going to win. I knew what was going on in the States with the protests. I knew the government was weakening. And I knew that we would go, and these people would have to stay. I didn't realize that a number would not have to stay, that many would leave with us or shortly after us. I knew that some people would stay, and I knew some people would die because I had invested. It's just as if I had played a role in getting people to invest in a bad investment, like I sold them faulty life insurance or something. Well, that's probably a good parallel. I had young people in class that were getting an English education, that were becoming invested in American education, that I knew would never be able in this country to use it, and then basically would discredit them, and they were wasting their time if they were going to stay in Laos. I mean, it was an enriching opportunity. It was fine to go someplace. And I think some of the kids saw that they would get out of the country ultimately. But a lot of them, like we talked about your experience with the volunteer that came back to Peace Corps and was negative, the action that I took basically was to speak up. I worked with the IVS committee. I spoke up at the IVS committee, went to the committee meetings. I think Walt was also on that committee. I spoke up and was vocal. Once a year, we would have a IVS board member come into country and talk to us. This was a lot like in religious life. We did the same thing. Once a year, you got this guy came in and he talked to you about your living arrangement and the order and stuff. It was a lot like religious life. And this guy come in. I was very vocal. He was not prepared to hear it. I think it was a Monsignor or something. It's a Catholic Monsignor. very conservative, and was not prepared to hear what I had to say about our presence in Laos, and that he was not.
Well, the IVS fellow was a Monsignor.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, because I thought you were talking about your your religious life, but you weren't. Okay.
No, it was similar to what they did in religious life.
Yeah.
But even some of the volunteers, I don't think, were really willing to or interested, and I can understand that what they were doing was probably inappropriate. Probably the people that were hardest to discuss this with were students. They didn't, they couldn't understand it, that I was saying that they were in danger, that America was not staying, that I could see that, and I don't know how I could see it. I could see it from the newspapers, I could see it from books. And it was clear to me that we were going, and these people would have to stay. That I could leave in a year, and they couldn't.
Yeah.
And they would have to stay here with credentials that were not going to help them and probably would hinder them. And I knew that was wrong.
Do you think the students just didn't want to face that
reality? Oh, I definitely don't think they wanted to face that reality.
Okay. So it wasn't that you had some insight because of outside sources of information, that they would have had other sources of information but would have been good information, but they just didn't want to take the next step.
If you're investing into something, if you're going to class every day and you're investing in this and you have high, high hopes for what this is going to do for you.
And you're young and you're full of life and enthusiasm.
And someone tells you that, no, that's not what's going to happen. And plus, you could see all the Americans. You could see all the money. I mean, some of these people came out of villages. Not all of them, but many came out of villages.
So poor.
Yeah. And we were opening something up. We were opening up a door that someone else in a few years was going to shut. And that was a hard thing. All I could do really was speak up within IVS, which I did. I think adequately. I hope not too much, and I talked to the students about it. Not greatly, because I realized they didn't want to hear it, and I didn't push it. But I did. I did make myself known on certain days where there would be protests and stuff like that in the States. I would wear a piece of black on my thing, which was a common thing to mourn.
For mourning, yeah.
And that's the story.
You mentioned that you worked with Fred Brandman. Were the opinions that he held instrumental in the reshaping of your own opinions?
I didn't see a lot of Fred.
Okay.
Fred didn't live with us. He didn't come to the compound very often.
Now, then I would...
I would run into him, and he would be at a party or something.
Not
necessarily an AID party, but he would be at some party, right?
Right.
See him. And certainly hearing him say what he had to say, you couldn't deny that he was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that, or at least he had a viable opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that contributed to it.
Okay.
But there, a lot of it was, I think, mostly Time and Newsweek.
All right, fine, fine. When I didn't pin this down before. Normally I did. I guess I'm out of practice here. But when, in 1968, did you arrive in Laos? What point in the year?
God, it had to be fairly early. I would say June, May or June.
So...
I finished school. I finished regular school, so it had to have been the regular school year, which would be May.
Okay.
Within a few weeks, I was in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and then out.
Then out.
Okay. So the Tet Offensive in Vietnam had already taken place.
I'm not so sure it didn't take place while I was there, but maybe it did.
Yeah, there was a second May Offensive in Vietnam, but the Tet Offensive was early in 68.
I know Vietnamization was starting, and I remember that very clearly, that I read Newsweek that Vietnamization, and then I started, you know, and that was a real clear sign that there was a problem when we started this thing where we're going to turn the war over to the Vietnamese, and I knew for a fact that the Vietnamese were not going to make it without a great deal of American soldiers there.
Mm-hmm.
And if Vietnam couldn't make it, clearly the Lao couldn't. Because the Lao had no interest in fighting. These were a very gentle people.
This is
not aggressive at all.
This is an admirable trait.
And I think
if all humans around the globe had that trait, we'd be terribly vulnerable to aliens, but that's okay.
The joke in Lao, it wasn't a joke really. It really was admiration on the part of people in Laos. Is they used to call the Lao the hippies of Asia.
Oh, really?
Yes. And these hippie songs, San Francisco music, that San Francisco, there was a very popular song there, and they had one called Massachusetts.
They just
loved those songs.
They did.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they were very, very much the hippies. And they were lovely people.
Yeah. Let me ask you, this might change gears a little bit, because I think that... Wait a minute. No, let me stay on this. I want to ask you about the IVS administration,
mm-hmm.
but before I do that, you said that you spoke out. You mentioned Fred Branfman. You were a friend, acquaintance of Walt Haney. I don't know if you were there at the same time as a guy named Wilson, T. Hunter Wilson.
I remember the name.
Okay. These people certainly were critics
mm-hmm.
of the American effort,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily of IVS, but at least of the American effort.
Mm-hmm.
But as I understand it, these were a minority of American IVS people who would make a criticism. Now you said that you criticized
mm-hmm.
in some of the meetings. Why do you think you became at least somewhat critical and were willing to make a statement, whereas other people would not?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I mean, people have these things. I mean, we have a term called ownership. You understand ownership?
Not really.
No. Ownership means like taking responsibility for something and saying, yeah,
okay.
That's me.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that I do that are inappropriate. For various reasons, okay? Or the opinions that I held for various reasons that I really shouldn't hold, but I do it because of this or that, because I have some ulterior motive, okay? I take ownership that I do that, that I take responsibility for the fact that I do that. And so I can't really criticize other people for doing that. But there are people in IVS and in any area, in government, I work in government now, people in government, people in education, they do things because they have a motive. They have something. And people were in Laos for a lot of different reasons. They weren't
mm-hmm.
there just. I wasn't there just to teach school. I was
mm-hmm.
there to have an experience. I was there because it was interesting. It was exciting. I was taking something away, as the gentleman said,
mm-hmm.
at the orientation
yeah.
that I was going to give.
You mentioned one woman who was husband shopping?
Yes. out of AID. There's a couple stories about the different people that were in that kind of a situation.
Yeah.
I don't want to say that it was going on a lot, but they were just stories. They were just funny things that happened. There were a lot of funny things happened. Because like you said, we go to dinner, people go to dinner as a regular base. You're with people all the time, and things get said, and funny things happen. Mm-hmm. Really funny things happen. I'll tell you one about that one. But at any rate, people were there. They didn't want to deal with the unpleasantness of having to take responsibility for this, take ownership of it. And why bother? I didn't do anything about it. I spoke out on it, but that's all I did. I didn't jump on a plane and come home, which may very well have been, if I were an ethical person, had done. When I realized what I was doing, that people were probably going to die because of the work I was doing to some degree. I mean, that might be a bit exaggeration, but it has some truth to it. I was selling something that was going to hurt these people, could hurt them, could hurt some of them, may help a few. That was inappropriate. I think people probably didn't really want to deal with that. They were much more, I'd like to go to the compound and have a hamburger and go to a movie and I'd like to go out and take a drive and go along the river and do this kind of thing. And that was just, different things appeal. For some reason, this was some area, and for some other people, this was an area that concerned them. It concerned me, or at least I'd like to think it concerned me.
Okay. No, that's a good human answer. Although I know it's speculative, because we can't crawl into everyone's head and see exactly what's going on. But you were there, so that you knew some of these people.
My concern to some degree is that we don't do that again.
Yes.
And I think about that every so often, that Vietnam, and I've thought about that quite a bit, because you can't really think of Laos separate from Vietnam. You can't think of Cambodia separate from Vietnam. Though it was Indochina, it wasn't just Vietnam. It's just Vietnam is where most of the blood was let. But later there was blood let in Cambodia, and there was some blood let in Laos. I don't think we know that something happened in Vietnam. We know we probably shouldn't have gone. But we really haven't examined it after all this time.
Uh-huh.
And all the talk and the talk about people missing in action, all this kind of stuff. I don't think we've come to, I really, from my personal view, I don't think we've come near grips with Vietnam. I don't know if we ever will come to grips with it. I don't know whether, as Americans, we can come to grips with it. But until we come to grips with it, I think we can repeat it.
Uh-huh.
Because we have to take ownership before we can change, and I don't think we really take ownership of what happened there, in the decisions that we made. They were very poor decisions, and in hindsight, even Robert McNamara says we're big decisions. I don't think as a country we are really dealing with this. And if you, like as a history professor, if you don't learn your history, in my case, if you don't take ownership of our history and what I'm talking about, we can repeat it.
Yeah. Very true.
I don't think we ever want to repeat Vietnam.
No, not at all. Let me pause this for a second, because I want to tell you, turn that back on again. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the IVS administration.
Okay.
Because we've talked a little bit. We haven't gone into a great deal of the actual teaching that you did in the classroom, but I think that's not quite as important to what we're doing now as I'm sure it was on your day-by-day basis, consumed you on a day-by-day basis. But who did you have most contact with in the IVS Laos administration?
Jim Malia.
Jim Malia, okay.
Jim was the, he sort of, after the other fellow left, I forget what his name was, Mr. Johnson. When Mr. Johnson left, I think Jim became the, took his job.
Okay.
And Jim had been a rural volunteer,
uh-huh.
And so Jim was very solid. He knew what he had to do. He knew his job. He was very understanding of the volunteer and the volunteer situation, but he also had administrative responsibilities that he had to meet. I don't think internally in the country, I don't think it was a problem, and I can't fault them. I think they did a good job. I don't think they did a bad job. I think they could have done a better job.
In what ways?
This is only my opinion.
Oh yeah.
Okay, and there's a crossover. It could have been a mistake. But I think probably a lot more direction, a lot more idealism. Of course, it might not have worked out real well, but I mean, there was a job was done to run an organization, but it never got really beyond that. I don't think they really made use of a potential. I find this in government a lot. I go in my government thing, I look at people, and I see a lot of potential, but I don't see it really realized. It must be like what you see some of your students. You see potential in a student. You don't see it realized. And I think the same thing. I think there was a lot of potential in IVS. And I don't think it was totally realized. If it was realized, it was by people like Walt Haney, who was a self-starter and was a person that could do these things on his own and make those kinds of steps.
So you, let me interpret what I think you're saying. You would have wanted a much toned down, but a kind of direction and leadership from the IVS office that would have been much more focused, perhaps. A kind of discipline, not like the religious discipline, but in a sense more of a laying out of a path with clear goals and timetables and things like that that people could do.
And a little more idealism, a little more direction.
Idealism for
just looking at what are we doing and what can we do to do it better. What we call today quality improvement.
Okay.
How can we do this a lot better?
Because my impression of IVS is very idealistic.
Yeah.
How could you get more idealistic?
I don't think in the field that you feel that as much as you do in Washington. I mean, it's like the Pope. And when the Pope speaks, it sounds great. But in the reality of the church, is not what the Pope says.
Okay,
There's a lot of warts. Okay, and I think that's the deal difference. I mean, what we say and what we do, is do we do enough? Uh-huh. And there might have been over the years some very, very good leadership. I'm not faulting either Jim or Mr. Johnson. They're both very good. Jim was a great help to me. I can tell you that Jim was an enormous help, and I really enjoyed having him there, and I think he was incredibly helpful. But as an organization, I think in the field, they basically saw that you got a place to stay, that you had your money, you got your check on time, that your bank account was handled, and this kind of stuff. But it really never really got beyond that.
Ah, okay.
So you were really on your own. If you were a Walt Haney,
no problem. Yeah.
But yeah, you would have thrived in that. Yeah. Well, you see the difference?
Sure. Yeah, and I get back to my Peace Corps experience, and that we had pretty much the same sort of thing. The thing that saved a lot of people was that they would be linked up to the school system, which had a calendar that they had to adhere to. But then the problem would come in the summer. What do you do for the summer? Some people just would go around and travel. Other people had projects that they would get themselves linked up to that were wonderful, But it depends on the personality, not on Peace Corps law. Yeah.
We had a summer project, but nobody really took it real serious. You just had to tell them what you were going to do over the summer.
Yeah.
By the way, that is the Hilltop House. That is where, and it's strange that you're here, and we're sitting here, that is where the orientations take place for IVS, or did take place for IVS.
I've seen photographs of that.
Yes, that's Harper's Ferry.
Let me shut this off for a second. But we should probably finish up, sometime today. But let's see, we talked about Jim Malia just a moment ago, and I don't know, it's not necessarily a criticism of the organization, but what could have made it better, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Right.
Did you have much to do with Bob Lovin, who also was in position of authority?
He might have been there when I came. I remember, the name sounds familiar, but I don't remember him.
Okay. All right, so most of your dealings were with Jim Malia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was your focus.
Ben Iverson, what was the name the fellow you mentioned before? That's
Al Inverson?
Not Al Inverson, but the last one, just a few minutes ago you mentioned his name. He was also in administration. And you said that he was somewhere, I forget what you told me he is, but I think he was in administration too, at the school.
Ooh, because the only ones I mentioned is Lovin, and he was agriculture mostly.
No. A few minutes ago. I just mentioned him. I can't remember.
Oh, really? But when we were on tape?
No, we weren't on tape.
Ah, oh, okay. Because I was just trying to think of the last couple of minutes. Oh, I don't know.
Because he lived on grounds at the school. He had a house.
Oh, Woodson.
Woodson.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Woodson had a house.
Mm-hmm.
Malia
mm-hmm.
didn't. Malia lived in town, I think.
Okay.
He lived someplace else.
So, all right. But so then you were closer to...
Woodson. Oh, yeah, I remember Woodson.
Yeah.
I remember Malia I had more dealings with, but Woodson was right on grounds. So I saw him regularly, but I just didn't talk to him as much as I did Malia.
Because most of your dealings were with Malia?
Mostly with Malia.
Oh, okay. What about, an individual just went in and went out again. We got to get that on tape, and this one's going to run out very, very quickly here. But you just said something that I was... You know, made me leap for the tape recorder, and that was a qualification of an earlier statement. If you could repeat what you just said.
And I'm sorry I didn't say it, because this has been on my mind quite a bit. As critical as I am of the fact that Americans had the involvement in Indochina and that IVS played a role in that, I realized that without AID, without American government funds, IVS couldn't have taken place. We just could not have put the number of people in the field that were put in the field because of
uh-huh.
AID. AID made my experience possible and made other people's experience possible. And you would not have had the number of people to interview last year had it not been for AID.
Yeah, and still more this year.
Yeah,
and that it was valuable.
Yeah. The question becomes, is like they say that out of war, good things come, heroism and this kind of stuff, but is uh-huh. the heroism, are the good things that come out of something worth the price that we pay for it? That's the question.
Yeah, and which brings me to